Welcome. It's February, and today we're focusing on a topic that is kind of exciting to Melody and I. I'd like to introduce it and also let you know. Oh, I think that's my bed. Conference. I have to do that.
Conference
there
muted.
There we go. Are you there, Melody? Can you talk?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. At the end, we're going to try and reserve some time for people to share or to ask questions, and then we'll tell you how to unmute yourself. What Melody and I are going to do over the next hour with you, half hour with you, Edie Hirsch calls amateurism, and it just means we're going to reason one with another. What we really want to do is to think together. Usually in order to have a professionally accepted conversation like this, we would need to have statistics, research, proofs, and accepted terminology. And if we did that, we would get stuck in issues and really couldn't even have this conversation. If, after the hour we've spent together, all we have accomplished is to inspire each of us to have stronger families, to love each other more deeply, to help take care of our neighbors, then our time together will have been worthwhile. For a moment, let's name and review the power structure of freedom this year. We've been focusing on freedom, and we've looked very closely at the power structure of freedom, and we've been talking about five different trends and the impact they're having on the power structure of freedom. So just for 1 minute, I'll go ahead and name the five levels of the power structure of freedom and then introduce the third trend. The first level in the hierarchy in the power structure of freedom is self, which is our impact on ourself. And it basically is that we have agency and we are free to choose. We're free to choose our response to stimuli. We're free to choose many things. And the hope is that we will choose good over evil. The hope is that we will choose to control our own states, to be in a place of openness, not in a negative state of complaining and blaming. And we've talked about this a lot. Let's go to level two. Level two is we have the freedom to impact our own family, and we hope that we can encourage them to do level one well. Level three is our impact on other individuals. We can help them embrace level one and be happy through right living. Level four is the impact on other families. We can help relieve suffering of all kind and give service. And level five is our impact on government forms in all levels. Now, hopefully you have pen and paper. You can jot down some of the things that we share. We're going to be specifically asking the question in a minute. Let's go to trend number three. The ones that we've discussed already, we'd started with trend number five, actually, that there are many people who are freedom lovers and who love freedom, who do not understand the power structure of freedom, and they are being ineffective in their efforts to promote freedom. That was trend number five. Then we went to trend number one, which is that our rights, there's propaganda that our rights are derived from the government. And then trend number two, the trend to enact laws based on scarcity. And now we're on trend number three. And this trend is not something new. It's been around for thousands of years. But when the great experiment of the United States was embarked upon, the founders chose to follow Locke's advice, believing that there is a set of laws called natural laws, which are governed by God, and that man would do well if he set up positive or man-made laws that were an extension of natural law. Trend three is the trend to swing in the other direction, to pass unnatural laws through legislation, meant to revoke or try to control natural law. Melody, why don't you introduce us to some history and some language that will give us some background.
Okay. So, first of all, let's talk about what is natural law. Now, this conversation has been going on for many, many years, whether or not there is natural law or if natural law exists, and what is the definition of natural law. It's a conversation that has been debated and disputed for literally thousands of years. There were some thinkers that the founders really used and really relied upon for a definition of natural law, and one of them was John Locke. Now, of course, like I said, there are other definitions, and we may go into that a little bit, but let me just give you a background for what John Locke said about natural law. So he says all men are created equal. He means all men are created equal in that they were created in a state of nature. Okay? But in that state of nature, they do not have free license to behave however they will want to behave. They cannot use what he calls uncontrollable liberty. Not at their disposal. He says, in that state of nature is a set of laws that govern it. So the state of nature is not the state of license. The state of nature is being under the law of nature. The laws of nature. And he says, in the state of nature, we are bound to preserve ourselves and mankind. And what laws are they that preserve ourselves and mankind? He says, the laws that preserve us are laws that have to come from a higher power, or something beyond something we understand. So if people want to call that a law of nature, a law of God, they can call that that. In order to understand what the natural law is, though, they have to recognize that there is something beyond themselves. Now, there has been a trend to disempower or even refute the state of nature, the laws of nature. And if you'll just give me a second, my computer just shut down, and I need to get a reference. So there was a, back in the, after the country was founded, you may have thought that the argument was done, that we had already decided, well, yes, there is a state of the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is what we govern by. But the argument wasn't over. There still were people who just didn't believe that there was such a thing as the laws of nature. And there was a Supreme Court justice in the early 1900s, 1902, he became a Supreme Court justice. His name was Oliver Wendell Holmes, and he did not believe in the state of the laws of nature. He believed in creating law based on experience and not logic. And he was one of the very first Supreme Court justices who was a proponent of passing law or creating law based on experience instead of logic. I just want to read to you what it says here. He was opposed to the doctrine of natural law, marking a significant shift in American jurisprudence. Up until that point, most people accepted the notion of natural law in this country, and most things were, most legislation was measured against natural law, And since the Constitution was supposed to have been written based on natural law, adherence to the Constitution was much more in vogue. But with the introduction of this new line of thought that we create legislation based on experience, laws based on experience, and not through logic or natural law, things began to change. As he wrote in one of his most famous decisions, his dissent in Abrams versus the United States in 1919, he regarded the United States Constitution as an experiment, as all life is an experiment, and believed that as a consequence, we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions. So we should never check people's opinions, because everyone's opinions was based on their experience, and experience was everything, and whether it was logical or not. That we should be loath, that we loathe and believe to be fraught. We should be not worried about opinions that we loathe and we believe to be fraught with death, because it could be the next best thing for all of us. And he began to legislate from the bench in the early 1900s, and he held that position for about 20 years. He was one of the oldest Supreme Court justices in history. He held his post until he was 90 years old. That set an interesting trend for the United States. Now, people—it's interesting because people are going to say, "Well, when, what day did this start? Did this descent from natural law begin?" Well, it's hard to detect. There was a lot of talk about whether or not natural law was something you could really define. And the biggest problem that we had in the United States is we have this idea of separation of church and state. So if we're believing in natural law and we have a separation of church and state, we cannot be proponents of any certain religion. So there was a big movement around the turn of the century towards humanism, which would be anti-God, anti-religion. Most humanists are atheists. And so the atheists at the turn of the century could believe in natural law or something outside of themselves, bigger than themselves. But as the tradition was passed on from generation to generation, they've lost the sense of doing good to yourselves and doing good to others through believing in something beyond yourself. And now it's completely been, there is no God. We are all created, we all came out of the primordial soup, and there absolutely cannot be natural law that governs over the accident of the Great Bang or the Big Bang, or there is no law that governs over the law of evolution. Evolution just is, it just evolves, and there is nothing greater than that. So you can see that we're in a little bit of a quandary. We have to decide for ourselves now. We're left on our own now to decide what is the best for our world and our nation and our people if there's no law beyond ourselves that govern. And so so there is a trend called a grab for cultural hegemony. Because now we are free from natural law, the trend is toward being free from natural law. Now we just have to be in control of our culture. So at about the same time, the turn of the century, some interesting things were going on during this whole time. The communists began to have their revolution. And they began, people think, oh, they didn't affect the United States, but they affected the United States to a very high degree. There's this philosopher-thinker named Antonio Gramsci, who is a who was a communist, and I want to read to you something that he said about getting power in by through the culture, because now there's no law governing over us. We can pass law or legislation. We can, all of our society can be based on the kind of culture that we create, and culture became the important word. And this is what Gramsci says: cultural hegemony is what he calls. He's not the originator, but the developer of the concept cultural hegemony, is a power term developed by communist Antonio Gramsci. Gramsci theorized that communism was having very little effect in the capitalist countries because capitalism held a hegemonic control over culture. Oh, Tiffany, could you just give us a definition of hegemony really quick? Just kind of tell us what that means.
The hegemony is power. It's a concentrated. So cultural hegemony would be cultural power.
Okay.
So, and control. How would you define it?
Concentrated. I think is a good idea. I mean, a good way to describe concentrated in a few people who are trying to be at the top of government or the top of the. Of the culture leading out. So it's not just one specific person necessarily, but maybe a few specific individuals who are championing a certain ideal. Okay.
You know, it's very interesting as you keep going.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that, of course, I know what Gramsci said, and I was going to say that Mao did the very thing.
He's having the
cultural revolution and saying these are the new rights and these are the old for old, and
he redefined
exactly,
their culture.
Yes, it was exactly through cultural hegemony. That's a really good example.
Gramsci was before Mao, and I'm sure Mao read him and was familiar with everything that he was a proponent of. So Gramsci argued that capitalism not only was maintained control through violence and political coercion, which I think is really interesting, that I don't think that you and I, Tiffany, would believe that capitalism was maintained through violence and political coercion, but maybe he has something there. of course, he's a communist, so he's anti-capitalist. But also through ideologically, through making the bourgeoisie values seem common sense. So the way they controlled was making the bourgeoisie values seem common sense, and so have become the values of all people, even the working class. Thus, a consensus of culture developed in which people in the working class identified their own good with the good of the bourgeoisie and helped to maintain the status quo rather than revolting. You know, he's coming from a communist point of view. But then he goes on to explain how you gain a cultural hegemony. He suggests that the proponents of communism create a cultural hegemony of their own, which would overthrow the notion that bourgeois values represented natural or normal values for society, and that would attract the oppressed and intellectual classes.
You know, whether it's communism that's trying to get the cultural hegemony, or it's an aristocracy that's trying to get the cultural hegemony, or it's socialism that's trying, or it's fascism that's trying, the point here is to understand that the strategy is through the culture.
Right.
interesting.
And so there was a group of people. There are lots. Like I told you, there's a lot of conversation about whether natural law was really true. And there was a group of people, Oliver Wendell Holmes being one of them, who just absolutely did not believe in natural law. And so this is what Gramsci says they need to do in order to change our culture, because our whole culture up to that point was completely sold on the idea of natural law, right? Because that's what the Constitution was based on and the founders proclaimed was the law of our nation. And this is what Gramsci says that they needed to do in order to change that culture. He says, if anyone wishes to dominate in modern conditions, has to move beyond its own economic corporate interests to exert intellectual and moral leadership, and to make alliances and compromises with a variety of forces. Now, I believe, Tiffany, that this is true all the way around, for good or for ill. If you want to have cultural influence,
impact.
This is what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you look at Washington, and he moved off his farm and went and helped. I believe it's true to an extent, because he also, by moving off his farm and becoming a general, okay, and not being able to enjoy the fruits of his labor, so to speak, but just go back out in the workforce and service force, right? He was, though, very much protecting his economic and corporate interests.
Yes, he was. He was.
And
so
there's
those
two sides. Yeah, it's two sides of the coin. Well, by getting them, yeah. Okay, keep going.
So, but basically what Gramsci is saying is you've got to look outside of yourself and look at other organizations that are supporting your same ideas, no matter who they are. I mean, this is his idea, and I think it's powerful and real. It's totally real. So, people like Oliver Wendell Holmes would look toward the intelligentsia that was supporting his ideas, and then he would make alliances with those people, whether they were politically on his same page or not. He didn't care. Now, it's very powerful. Now, some people would say, well, but that's a violation of my principles. Maybe not. If you want to have impact, this is the game they have played, and this is how they have been getting their ability to legislate not based on natural law anymore. So this is an analysis that Gramsci makes of the United States and how he proposes that they infiltrate the United States. He says, in the West, bourgeois culture values are tied to religion. And therefore, much of his analysis of hegemonic culture is aimed at religious norms and values. He says that in order for anyone to get hegemonic control that would be outside of religious values, they have to attack religious norms and values. Very interesting, because I think a lot of my values come from my religion. For Gramsci, he says, Marxism could supersede religion only if it met people's spiritual needs. So the cultural that Oliver Wendell Holmes was a proponent of could only supersede religion if it met the people's spiritual needs. So not only are we now creating this belief that there is no natural law, but they have to somehow replace that with a fulfillment of a spiritual need. If there's no natural law out there, there's no God, so therefore, what is there? So let's give them something that will fulfill their spiritual needs. And to do so, people would have to think of it as an expression of their own experience.
And you're not even saying that Oliver Wendell Holmes was communist. You're simply saying that he was one of the ones that swung this trend.
Yeah, he just understood cultural hegemony, and the people around him understood cultural hegemony. Whether or not they were trying to be proponents of communism doesn't matter. What Gramsci says about cultural hegemony is true.
Is what matters.
So they have an agenda. They have an agenda, and Gramsci gave them some specific things they had to do. They had to make alliances with people that agreed with them, whether they stood on the same principles or not. And they had to create some kind of religious experience outside of religion that people believed were their own. So the trend to start passing legislation not based on natural law or outside of natural law
could be accepted.
Had to start with some kind of cultural hegemony.
Okay, now we have a challenge for everyone. We want you to think and maybe on a piece of paper write some things down. And I spoke with three different people. We didn't talk about this topic, but this week three different people shared with me just on their own accord what they felt were unnatural laws that are either bills in the House or that are coming up or that have been passed or that we're going to see things that are happening because of it or it's on their mind. So right now, we just want you to write down between one and three policies, bills, legislation that you feel is unnatural. And we can define right now, we can talk about Bastier for just a minute, and the law and how he says that we need to use our faculty to promote life. And we have to have the freedom or the liberty to do that, and we have to have property to do that. We should laws should be based on our ability to promote our life, to extend life.
But that's what Locke says is natural law.
Exactly.
It's the law that governs the state of nature. We're not in a state of license. We need to preserve ourselves and others.
So
what the natural law is.
Any legislation that you feel goes against man's ability to promote their life, basically. We can just put it that simple. Go ahead and jot it down. And Melody and I are not delving into those specific issues, but we want you to think about those issues while we continue having this conversation. So trend three, the trend to pass unnatural laws, this is an extension of trend number one, that all rights originate from man, not from God. Let's look at the impact that this trend has on freedom. And this won't take us very long to go through these five, and then we want to hear from you. The first one, the first level, which is self, that we're free to choose good or evil. When unnatural policy is put into place, what is the impact on self? That's our question, and we want you to write for a minute. We're going to share our thoughts with you. We want you to go ahead and write. Think about what you just wrote, something that you feel is trying to be passed right now that goes against our ability to promote life, all right, and then answer the question, what is the impact of this trend on the individual? On you,
okay, so you're talking about
self.
if I just looked at myself and said, hey, if there are laws being passed that are not based on natural law, or there legislation being created not based on natural law, what's the impact it's going to have on me, the law itself, or are you saying just the cultural belief is going
both,
to have on
both
me?
Of them, both parts,
okay,
the cultural belief. And the law itself, the policy itself.
Okay,
what is
so
it?
The cultural acceptance that it's okay to pass laws or to pass legislation.
Well, and what happens culturally when that law is passed? both culturally
yeah. okay.
and
the impact that okay
yep,
so the impact it has on them. Okay.
Yeah. So everyone think for a minute. If you're listening to this call later, we know that we have hundreds of people who listen later. We have some who listen now. You might be driving in the car, whatever it is, just want you to think. But you have to think of the other one first and then ask yourself, how does this impact me as an individual?
That's a really intense question. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, you told us to think about legislation that's being passed.
Okay, I'll just...
Not vague.
Yeah, it's hard if we can't share any. A friend of mine just barely shared one. Let's make it hypothetical. Let's pretend this isn't true. Let's pretend it's just hearsay, but let's pretend that some nation passed something like this, okay?
Okay.
Something as simple as people can no longer store seeds.
Store seeds.
Store seeds.
Okay.
I have a great.
No matter what kind of seeds, they just can't store seeds unless you have a farmer's license or something like that.
Exactly. Only licensed people can store seeds. I have a grandmother. She's in her 90s. She's on my husband's side. She always, when she grows her food, she always lets it go to seed, and then she gathers the seeds, and then she dries them. And she has this little place above her fireplace that dries all of her seeds. And, okay, so you can no longer store seeds. She would no longer be allowed to do that. Just think of that. What is the impact on...
Well, that law is not very enforceable, but... Yeah, okay.
On self. I'm just throwing one out there. But just
okay.
think for a minute.
Mm-hmm. If that law was passed, then I think that I would no longer have the... Well, I'm not much of a seed store, but if I had a law that was passed against it, first of all, I would think, wow, those people who do store seeds and are all gardener people, they're going to be against the law, and there must be something wrong with that, and so therefore I should never engage in anything like that. And then I think my whole ability to choose good and bad becomes clouded.
Okay, good. So on the one hand, you're judging someone who's storing seeds and you're scared to associate with them because they
yeah.
must be bad.
Mm-hmm.
What you see as good and evil becomes clouded. What you see as natural and right becomes clouded because it must be bad if it's illegal. Now, what about the one who's storing seeds and has her whole life? She's in her 90s. Is she going to stop storing seeds?
No.
No.
She's not.
So she won't. So it promotes cheating. And it promotes a black market and lying.
So you're saying my granny is going to be part of this black market?
Yeah, she's not going to go buy her seeds from that place. She's going to continue to store her seeds and grow her garden. Now she's one of the few. There's not a lot like this, but she is one of the few that grows 80% of what she consumes.
Well, I'm thinking also too that that it puts me in a state of self-deception because I can begin to justify now my actions against people like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's part of the cultural effect and why the cultural hegemony is so effective. Because it can turn you against someone who does want to promote life. If you're on that side, and if you're on the other side, and this truly happened, I know when I went and visited Hungary, just to have a pencil, one of the things that happened in the home is that parents could not talk to their children about their true feelings. They were scared to even talk to their own kids because of what was illegal.
You're not necessarily saying because of the economic philosophy that was guiding them, but the things that they made illegal.
Yeah, just even the things they made illegal, they couldn't talk to their children about their old views about anything religious. Basically, within two generations, it wiped out belief in God because they didn't dare talk to their children about anything like that, because the children at school, the children would be questioned and the parents would be turned in. I saw videotapes of this. I saw people talking about this. It can happen so swiftly and so quickly. That's why we bring it up. Let's look at number two, the impact on the family. Helping your family, just what is the impact on the family? Now, everyone, look at the ones that you wrote down. Pick one of the brainstorms that you wrote down about any policy or legislation or bills or anything that seems to go against your right to life and the extension of that life, okay? And say, if that's passed, what's the cultural effect on your family? And
okay,
what is the lawful effect on your family?
So we're gonna use the hypothetical can't store seeds.
Yeah, but
okay,
first of all, I'm going to be quiet for 30 seconds and just let people think of their own for a minute. Everyone write, what's the impact on family?
Can I ask you a really quick question, though?
Yeah.
What's the possibility that that would really happen? I mean, that's kind of ridiculous, right? Someone passing legislation that you can't store seeds, right?
It seems as ridiculous as forcing someone to have health care.
Oh, I know your views. Okay.
No, I think health care is really important.
Okay. I'm just wondering.
So,
I mean, seems ridiculous.
Okay. Yeah. So it seems ridiculous that you can't store seeds. What is the impact on the family? Let's go ahead and look at this one right now. What happens to a family, to both families, okay, your family, Melody, who doesn't store seeds, and you're looking at other people and you think, boy, they're bad when they store seeds, and the impact of the family who knows they're still storing seeds, right?
Or on the family who knows they can't store seeds, so therefore, what's the message being given to them, and so they don't store seeds.
Right. Right. First of all, one of the things that happens is the rights of the mother and the father are usurped. You know,
ooh,
all my great-grandma's life, she's had the right to grow food, to harvest the seeds from that food, and to grow it again. So the rights of the father and the mother to propel their family forward are usurped.
And it affects their family culture too, because if their family culture is a gardening culture, and the only way you can afford to garden is to, you know, maybe that family can only afford to garden by
storing their
seeds. You know,
yeah.
It also is going to affect any kind of family business of growing. You know, growing businesses. I have a neighbor down the street that they have this little corner lot that they grow things on all the time. It's a little family business.
And their excess they're able to share with their neighbors and through barter and through selling. It's true. And maybe that's one of the laws that's out there, that you can't sell your food unless you have a license. That could be one. It's changes the roles within the family. Say, for instance, that there's a law that you can't store food. You can't hoard food. I know that for my grandma, her role would change dramatically. She spends at least 3 months out of the year storing food.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
But whether it was that or a different one that you came up with, one of the things that happens is the rights of the mother and father are usurped, often by government agencies and policies, but they are usurped, and that roles change within the family. Okay, number three, what is the impact on other individuals?
So if I were to think about... what's the impact of myself? How is that different from what's the impact on other individuals?
Right. You kind of named it with level one because you being someone who's not a seed store, could look at someone else who is and you could judge them and think they're bad.
Yeah, because I can prove that they're bad through the use of...
That they're not following the law.
Yeah, that they're not following the law.
Yeah. And so it's caused a division from one individual to another. So it's divisive.
Okay.
And good people become the object of persecution. Good people who are following Bastier's reason that we have the right to extend our life through our faculties and that therefore we need to have control over our own property. And we need to own property because that's the only way to have the extension of life. We're defining that as good people. People who try to do that are now the object of persecution.
So I think that we become the object of biased research and sophistry too, and their own rhetoric, because they have to prove that the law is just. So culturally, they have to explain to us how we, why it's, you know, meets some kind of religious standard for ourselves or spiritual standard for ourselves. Why this law is just.
It's really interesting. I remember the part in Red Scarf Girl when G. Lee heard her parents in the bathroom and she could smell smoke. And she finally knocked on the door and they allowed her to peek in and they were burning all of their family pictures. Why were they burning all of their family pictures? Because they owned property. They owned clothing that was beautiful. They owned furniture that was beautiful. They had owned the property, and there were pictures of them with their property. Of course, you're wearing your clothes in your picture. Of course, you're standing in your living room by your nice bed set in your picture. You know what I mean? Or something. And they were burning their family records because they were now the object of persecution. Because now it was no longer okay to have property or to even come from the lineage that once held property.
So
this is real stuff. What's that?
Yeah. I was just going to say this is real stuff. So I don't know if you've heard about the school in Washington State. They put a ban on Legos because there were a group of kids that were building this big, huge Lego city, and they started to want to have ownership of little parts of the city. And the school felt like ownership was not one of their, individual ownership was not one of their values.
Values,
that they,
school values.
Yeah. This is real. This really happened in Washington. Really happened. The school banned Legos for a period of time, and then they reintroduced Legos and said you can play with Legos only if you play with them in groups and there's no ownership. And you can't have any buildings bigger than a certain amount.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, we're going on to number four. What's the impact on other families?
Talk about cultural hegemony.
Yes. You can walk into any elementary school down here where I'm visiting in St. George, and you can see the values that they're promoting up on the wall. Multiculturalism is one.
Yeah.
And the kids don't even know what it means. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting. Okay. What's the impact on other families? Okay, if we can't store seeds, like we said, and say an extension of that one is that you can't grow food and let other people buy your excess.
I think it affects our ability to help other families for sure, right?
It kind of feels like it, at least legally.
At least legally
to help other people. families turn in families.
Yeah, they do.
And family crumbles under the pressure to conform. Families themselves crumble. Now, it all depends on you know, what state. Is it at the beginning? Is it the end? How much pressure is there? The good becomes bad. Families don't trust other families. One of the things, because the roles of the parents have been usurped, the rights of the parents have been usurped, there's less respect for parents' decisions.
Well, I'm just thinking, Tiffany, I know you and I started this conversation by saying talking about seeds, but let's talk about laws that are created not based on natural law. So basically, the family is, John Locke is a great proponent for the family. He says it's the center of the center unit of society, because that's where the family learns how to adhere to natural law. So if we change laws and there, we say there is no natural law, there's very little use for the traditional family.
Absolutely. And that's one, when the family, the traditional family is gone, that's a really, really, really good sign that almost all freedoms are almost going to be extinct, even the freedom of religion. You destroy the family, you've even destroyed freedom of religion, which is a freedom that was one of the basis of forming the government of the United States.
Well, it's really true, because why do we have religion that perpetuate? You know, it'd be very easy for us if we lived on our own to just live our own selfish lives. But once we propagate and we have children, all of a sudden we have to think about, you know, what are we giving them? How are we going to help them to have a meaningful life? And then life comes back into focus for us.
It's interesting how Locke said that the family is the, what did you call it? What were his words?
The center unit of society?
The center unit of society. It definitely happens that the families, when this trend is followed and accepted culturally and legislatively and enforced, then the impact on families is that families crumble. That's the impact. The impact is that the family unit is destroyed.
Well, and I think we see a lot of that right now, right? We're seeing a lot of family crumbling.
Yeah.
Because
It's really interesting. I remember one time being with a group, and we were going to read Jane Eyre. And a very religious fellow said, "We can't read Jane Eyre. There's adultery in Jane Eyre." And I remember thinking, but I didn't say this, but I just kind of thought, but it shows the natural consequence for the adultery.
Right.
I'm going, this is a really good book to read. You go watch any movie, and it shows adultery, but it doesn't show the natural consequence for adultery. Some will show that they're unhappy. Some will show that the children's lives have been destroyed. Some will show the lack of self-confidence and the feelings of being lost and who am I. Some will show the tears. Some will show the natural following of committing adultery. But what percentage of the time, 8 out of 10 movies that show adultery show it as the norm and that it's happiness? Anybody that you know who's committed adultery, you ask them how happy they are in real life. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And they'll lie to you. Just kidding.
Most
right,
tell you the truth that they're miserable.
True.
But okay, impact on government forms, number 5. What is the impact on forms of government when unnatural law is accepted and passed?
Well, I think our government form changes, right?
Yeah.
Which I think we've seen over in the last century, is our government form changing. You know, I was I was doing some research from one of the papers I'm writing right now, and I was reading about how people are arguing about what form of government we have. People are saying, oh, we have a constitutional republic, and some people are saying, oh, no, we live in a democracy or republic. Some people are saying, oh, no, we live in whatever, whatever. But the truth of the matter is what we're supposed to be living in and what we live in are two different things.
Right.
Because it depends
right.
on...
It's been changing. Well, like you said, he started legislating from the bench.
Right.
Homestead. I mean, that's not the form that was here the first 100 years.
No, uh-uh.
You know, yeah, so and power, sometimes governments can assume too much power, especially if they're taking the roles and the natural rights that the parents used to have. One of the things is rather than deriving the power from the consent of the government, or of the governed, I mean, rather than deriving the power from the consent of the governed, a government issues rights and for a time is strong-armed and corrupt. It promotes a black market. And in order to know what rights to give to the people that are governed, the government defines the highest values. Like you said, Gramsci says they have to do, and gets the people to buy into it through the cultural hegemony.
I would love to spend some time talking about what that cultural hegemony is right now. We're not on that subject, but if you guys all would take a minute to after this call to kind of define what the cultural hegemony is right now. Apparently, Gramsci says there's always some kind of cultural hegemony. You just have to discover it and find out what it is.
It's very interesting. That's a really, really good question to bring up in our families to talk about the cultural norms right now that are accepted in schools, in public, and versus what is the family culture.
Exactly.
That you specifically promote. Okay. In the beginning, Anelody and I shared with you our hope that if in some small way this conversation helps each of us live better, understanding our personal freedom to choose our responses and to choose wisely, if this conversation inspires us to embrace the power that we have in our home. I mean, if we really think about that, Anelody, it's so liberating to think that right now, honestly, most of us, I know that one of the things that one of my friends mentioned is children being taken away from a couple simply because they were Christian and they homeschooled. That's one case in a few million. It's sort of scary. But really, we have power in our homes. And if this conversation inspires us to embrace that power in our own homes and teach and help our families to know their power over good and evil,
yeah.
And if this conversation causes us to help other individuals and families in their daily struggles to survive and thrive, then our time has been worthwhile.
So the one thing that I really want to promote is that the Constitution was based on the notion of natural law. And the reason why I support and want to uphold the Constitution is because of that. Not because the Constitution was necessarily made by man that were enlightened or whatever, but because it was based on natural law. So if you follow the line all the way back, you can say to your children and have a conversation with your children, we believe our country was founded on natural law. Let me explain to you what that means. Natural law means that there is a law governing us in a state of nature. It is not that we are at license to do whatever we want to do in the state of nature. And how we are created equal is that we are all subject to that natural law.
And that we all, like Bastiat says, have the right to life, and therefore liberty and property, because that's what gives us life, the faculty to use those.
Right.
just having that conversation with your children can be powerful. And I think will begin to create a whole new culture that would be able to stand up against the new cultural hegemony. And
okay, let's
that
go ahead. And, keep going.
That we will be empowered to stand up against laws that are trying to be passed that are against natural law.
Yeah, against our ability to live. All right, let's go ahead and take some comments and some shares. Let's see, all you have to do is press 5-star, and I will see your hand raised on my screen, and I'll unmute your line. So I'll just go up and down this. We have several people on the call with us. So we hope somebody wants to share something. And I can see some of your names, and so I can always unmute you and ask you questions. Okay, we've got someone. The number ends in 2205. Tell us your name.
This is Lynn.
Lynn, hi.
Hi. I have a question in regards to specifically how you, I mean, these are beautiful forms, but the very last statement that Anality made about, you know, standing up for laws that go against natural law. I mean, how is that specifically, how do you see that being achieved? Through letter writing? I mean, for the most part, we are among a minority because people are blinded. Therefore, I don't foresee being listened to by our lawmakers at this point.
Okay. Thank you for that question, and that is a really awesome question because that's the question people are always asking, right? So let me tell you something. We have a tendency to want to be on our own. We have a tendency to be very nomadic, our generation especially. And so, therefore, we've all just pulled ourselves out and separated ourselves, and we become separatists, right? But separatists on our own. We think we're by ourselves, but we're not. And I will tell you, there are some organizations that I feel like have really gotten the whole spirit of let's join together and fight against this kind of stuff. I'm a proponent of Gramsci's idea of cultural hegemony. I am a proponent of it. I think that we need to be getting involved in our community affairs, looking for organizations to align ourselves with. Let me give you an example of one here in Bountiful that I think is really fabulous. United Women's Forum. They have a wonderful little group of women who are really, really excited about fighting for the family. And so they have a group that go to the legislature every year. They kind of look at what bills are being presented, and they say, hey, this one is going to be destructive to the family. Let's fight against it. And it's not hard for me to be a part of that little organization. I go to a meeting once every 3 months. When legislation comes, they email me a few of their ideas about legislation that's happening, and then I go and help them lobby against it, or I go and help them. I take my kids up there and help them lobby, and that's part of our school sometimes.
Okay. Very good. So what we're hearing from you is to do number 5 seems almost impossible right now. Is that what you're kind of feeling, to have the, if you're doing number 1, 2, 3, and 4 and you're doing your best there, how do you do number 5? Is that what you're
And let me tell you, let me tell you another thing, Tiffany. Joining and creating Commonwealth schools is creating a cultural hegemony. Because you're aligning yourself with other people with the same values, and you're becoming a strong organization.
and building relationships, doing number three and number four, which is helping individuals and other families, does number five also.
It does. Totally, because it opens people up to having those kinds of conversations.
And this is not a fast, there is no quick fix.
No.
For what's taken us 110 years to get someplace.
That's right.
It's not. That's why it's really good to review 1 through 4, because we can see some results there where number 5 takes longer to see. Does that help you at all?
Mm-hmm.
And we also share in your pain of frustration.
Yeah. Wow, well, yeah. Definitely.
Do you have any other comments? Or? Okay. Let's go ahead and pick someone else. And what a great question you just asked. Thank you. Okay, we've got someone that the number ends in 8078.
Hey, Melody.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yes. Okay, who is this?
How did you find that group? So this is a follow-up question on the first person's question. So your solution was, well, you find these communities or of people who are promoting what you believe in, and aside from Commonwealth schools, which we already talked about, how did you find that?
Well, first of all, it was my Commonwealth school that found it, and we are very active people in our community. So when we talk and get together, we have, you know, we have a once a month meeting where we all come to our parent training. And so when we have a chance to socialize and get to know each other, we pass on information like that. And this was about 4 years ago that someone said, hey, I just found out about this organization this lady in my neighborhood is part of, and I was really interested in going and checking it out. What do you guys think? And, you know, we're like, yeah, let's go find out about it, you know. So just starting in one community. Another thing is I do occasionally attend city meetings. I have met some wonderful people through those meetings. So
thanks.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. We have time for at least two more shares. Just press 5-star. Okay, the number ends in 4339. Tell us your name.
Camille.
Hi, Camille.
Hi, Camille.
Hi.
How are you, Tiffany?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. As I've been listening, we have some issues in our Commonwealth right now where a lot of rules have been being made, and it's kind of upsetting to some of the students. I don't want to be specific about things, but it got me thinking about if we're really following a righteous pattern in obeying natural law, and how do we fit these kind of things, whether it's in our Commonwealth or in our families, when we set up rules or guidelines to be able to stay within natural law. I don't know if that question is very clear.
What you're saying is, how do you set up the minimal amount of policy that's based on natural law?
Yeah.
How do you know what laws are, how do you know what policy is based on natural law and what's not? Which one are you asking?
Camille, let me answer this question for you. It's a very simple answer. First of all, when you're writing your constitution, you have to know what the natural laws are of a community, and you need to set up the constitution to reflect the natural laws of community. The natural laws of community are not going to be the same kind of laws that govern a national government. There's
right.
going to be a lot different kinds of laws. So it may be a flaw in your form.
So you're saying maybe in the bylaws, we need to look at our bylaws, or
maybe a flaw in
it may be more deep than if you're just setting policy and there's something that's not correct in the actual constitution of your Commonwealth and your bylaws, it might be able to be solved there.
Right.
Yeah, it's probably a flaw in the form if you're having to create too many policy rules, procedural rules to control the children or control whatever.
That's probably
a flaw.
Saying.
I would revisit those bylaws, and if you need some help with that, give me a call.
Okay. Well, I'm not over that, but yeah.
Oh, that matter at all. We're one of the members, so you have all kinds of power to introduce the idea that there might be a flaw in your form. You're a member.
You know, as we were talking there, it dawned on me that. It kind of, we see this in our country too, that whenever there's an issue and it seems like some problem comes up, it seems like, because I don't know that it really is, but it seems like the answer is to make a new rule about it.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you.
Yeah, that's maybe not the answer.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You have to understand that the bylaws of your Commonwealth create your culture.
Wow. Okay.
Camille, I'll tell you what, Anelody, I'll talk to you later because Anelody and I are really talking about how to help all of the Commonwealths because we know that it's the right next step for us to be able to really build a foundation of strength and shared, just the whole thing. And so we can talk to you about some ideas that we've been having that might be able to help you. Okay, Camille?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. What a good, good, good question. Okay,
yeah.
The next number is 8078. I think we may have already done this. Let's have a look.
This is just a comment about how to learn about natural law, A really good series of books was written by Richard J. Maybury, Whatever Happened to Justice, Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, whatever, all these titles. And he teaches about natural law, and he talks about the two main laws that make all civilization possible. The first is do all that you have agreed to do. And the second one was do not encroach on other persons or their property. And based on those two laws alone, you can tell whether or not something is adhering to natural law.
Yeah, and
that's
don't you think
amazing.
It's very...
That could be part of your bylaws versus having 1,000 policies.
Right. And don't you think it's really interesting that those two laws right there depend on the morality of the people, the virtue of the people?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you look at the Ten Commandments, each one of those, you can point to it and say whether or not it follows do all that you say you will do or agree to do, or encroaching on another person or their property.
Can you give us the author again? I think some people will be interested in that.
Richard J. Maybury, Maybury, he writes a series of books called the Uncle Eric series.
Okay. Richard J. Maybury, Uncle Eric. Thank you.
Yeah, and natural law is something he talks about all the time. He calls himself a natural law jurisprudent or something like that. So, anyway, yeah, they're a good series of books.
Awesome. Thank you very much for that. Actually,
okay.
can I put in my 2 cents worth on that? I think those books would be an excellent way to start a conversation with your children. Grab one of those books, start reading it to them. I have to tell you, though, there are some things that I disagree with them in those books, but because it's debatable, you know, because these things are debatable.
Good, and that's fantastic. That's what we need. We need debatable food for dinner.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And, you know, it's interesting. That's what I like to do, you know. My kids like to
get some debatable food for dinner. They enjoy that.
That's right. Fantastic. Well, do we want to take one more? Is there one more person just trying to get the courage to? Oh, good. Here we go. I think it's Raina.
Hello?
Hi. Hello.
Hi, this is Raina Stump.
Hi, Raina.
Hello. I was just, I heard in the announcements right at the beginning, Annelida, you said there was going to be a new Commonwealth training at the end of April. So would that help if we, I've been trying to set this up for years, where our whole board would go to one of these, and then would you be able to help us with our bylaws or constitution or whatever we call it, you know? Would
yes.
that be a place where you could do that?
Yes, I can do that.
Absolutely.
What did you say?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. When do you know?
Kelly Reyes is, yes, can you hold on a second? Let me look at my calendar.
Yeah.
I looked up the date wrong. Kelly, after conference call, every single time she emails it, it's a date. It's not there. So I'm going to look at my calendar, and I'm going to get the right day.
Okay. And where would it be also?
It's going to be in the Denver area.
In the what?
Melody.
In the Denver area.
Colorado, right?
Denver, okay.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
Now, we would like your feedback. We'd like to throw this out there. And Melody and I have been discussing if we
it's
want
the 29th,
to actually...
It's the 29th and 30th.
Okay.
Of April.
Of April.
Okay. That is Women's Conference weekend. Sorry.
I know. Well, we'd like everyone's feedback on an idea. And Melody, are you okay if I throw this out there for just a minute?
Okay.
Annelie and I have discussed actually making the creation of a Commonwealth organization a scholar project. And so you can, when you come to a LEMI training, you can actually pick a Commonwealth scholar project training. And after the 3 days of training, you would go home with a skeletal working bylaws to your community. And you would have a 13-week class where you would go home with a set of videos from Annelie and I and the workbook. They would just get their workbooks, but it would be a scholar project that your community would take from you, and you would train them in all of the principles that you were trained in at the training. That because we're finding it cost prohibitive to send, you know, 15 families from a community to come get trained by us. And so we want to make the materials available for you to take home with you, and you train them, and we feel like this will be one of the most, one of the most helpful things that we can do in building stronger. And so if that is something that you think would help your communities, shoot me and Annelie an email this week. Shoot us one today and say, please, that would help us, because getting 15 people to you is hard, but if we could take something home and actually have a skeletal working bylaws that we work with, and then we own it, and we get a shared vision, and we have the class that teaches all of the principles, and we get to discuss them, and we have our homework, and it would be so cost-effective, basically for the price of one person or two people getting trained, then you turn around and train your entire community. And it will be a lot of work on mine and Annelie's part and a major focus for our team to be able to put this together. But if this is something that you think, oh, my goodness, this will help us so much, please send us an email, because we're making the decision right now if we're going to spend the next 5 months creating this so that it's ready this summer at all of our trainings. All right.
Thank you.
Melody, do you have anything to say?
I'm just hoping that be able to start a conversation with our family and children, with our spouses and friends, and just start a conversation and start talking about natural law. What is it? And is it real? And if it is real, should our country be making laws based on natural law and only based on natural law? And are we making laws, or are we legislating outside of our boundaries, outside of our power?
Thank you. Okay, wonderful, everyone. Thank you. And I agree, it's been amazing to think about these things with each of you, to take our minds and focus and to realize the power that we have as parents, as friends, as families, as individuals, and to see where our duty lies. And we wish you the best of happiness. Also, next week, Sherry Gagan, please let all of your schools know this. This is a free conference call next week. Same line you have now, and it's on the play production. So
on how to produce a play?
On how to produce a play. Anybody who's involved with producing your play in your Commonwealth schools, next Saturday morning, normal time, get on, you know, pass this number out, get on the call, and Sherry's going to be focusing on how to produce a play.
Awesome. So. Very good. Thank you so much. It's good to talk to you all today.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.